the stabilizer, there's the fact that the Hall group either commutes or anti-commutes.
Right, for the argument that it's abelian.
Yeah, but for other groups, that might not be true, right? Are they still abelian? Is the stabilizer still abelian?
I guess the most general thing you could do is instead of saying, let's take all the polys that have this property, that the code words are plus one eigenstates, that you take, say, all unitaries that have that property. And then it's only true that it's abelian on the subspace. I mean, if you kind of restrict the unitaries to the code space, then they have to commute on the code space. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, it's easy to come up with examples of, if you just take any two operators that, you know, fix the code space, but only act on the code space, so they're rotations within the code space, say, and then take the direct sum with anything else on the orthogonal space, that will be an operator that fixes the code space, I guess it's not a rotation. It fixes all the code words. But then it's direct sum with anything else, right? That will still be an operator that fixes the code space, but obviously two such things don't have to commute with each other, right? Because on the rest of it could be anything. So it's a special property of the poly group. But more generally, it is, of course, the case that that these are operators that are supposed to have simultaneous eigenstates. And if they commute, you know, that's definitely possible. And if they don't commute, it's generally not the case. But certainly commuting on a subspace makes it possible.
We only ever use the fact that it's abelian in the code word subspace?
No. The point is that what we want to do is we want to focus on the polys, the stabilizer that's a subgroup of the poly group, specifically because it has these other properties. And the fact that, you know, they either commute or anti-commute is just one of those properties. But there's a bunch of properties that it has that makes that a much more tractable thing and more useful to look at than just kind of arbitrary unitaries that have that property.
I see. So do people not usually look at stabilizers for groups other than the poly group?
So there's generalizations of the poly group to q-dits. That have similar but not the same properties. So it's no longer either commuting or anti-commuting. It's commuting up to some phase omega. And people have looked at even generalizations beyond that. But what you'll find is that I haven't kind of listed all the properties. I won't list all the properties, but I'll list it some more today. And those properties start to break down, and it just becomes harder to work with them. You'll see that we'll use some of these other polygroup properties more during today than we just did in that little bit yesterday. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
For the error correcting, when we said like for multi-qubit errors, how did we decide that we could deal with them again? Could you remind me?
Right, so I didn't show you any codes that actually did that, but for instance, you could easily imagine generalizing the 9-qubit code to, say, if you had a repetition code with 2t plus 1 qubits, right, that'll correct t bit flip errors, right? And so if you had the 9-qubit code generalized to the 2t plus 1 squared code, that'll correct, you know, bit flips on up to t qubits and phase flips on up to t qubits. And therefore, it'll correct polys on up to t qubits, arbitrary x, y, and z on up to t qubits. Because the y is, remember, an x and a z, and they're separate in the 9-qubit code. And so the point is that if you look at an arbitrary thing on t qubits, that's going to be a 2 to the t by 2 to the t matrix. And the basis for the space of 2 to the t by 2 to the t matrices is the polys on t qubits. And therefore, you can write the arbitrary thing as a sum of polys. So you get a superposition of them. And then when we measure the error syndrome, we're going to collapse to some particular poly. And that will actually be the error kind of conditional on the measurement result. Okay. So it's the same thing as for the single qubit errors, just kind of generalized. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so yeah, so let's continue talking about stabilizer codes. So, I'm afraid to bring it down now, but try, okay. Huh? I see. Okay. Well, I won't put it all the way down. Let's leave a little space. Okay. So remember last time, specifically for the example of the non-qubit code, but more generally, I said we can define, so given some subspace, which is our error correcting code, and this I call it T, we can let the stabilizer be the set of M in the Pauli group such that M psi equals psi for all psi in T. And remember the stabilizers had three properties. Well, yeah, three properties, which I'll boil down to two. So minus identity is not in the stabilizer, and S of T is an abelian group. Group being one property and abelian being another. So what I want to do today is go the other way. So it turns out that somebody can give you an abelian group that's a subgroup of the Pauli group, and you can derive a code space from that by kind of inverting this definition. So let's call this A and B. Given S subgroup of the Pauli group, which is an abelian group that does not contain minus the identity, then we'll let T of S be the set of states such that M psi is equal to psi for all M in the stabilizer. Okay, and so this is going to define now our subspace, which is going to be a quantum error correcting code. Of course, I mean, you know, depending on how we pick S, it might be a good code or a really lousy code, but we'll get to that in a little bit. It turns out that looking at the stabilizer, the group itself is already enough to tell you quite a lot about the properties of the code. In fact, it's an easier thing to deal with than the original subspace, particularly if you have to, you know, write the elements of the subspace in terms of standard basis. So why is that? Well, one reason is just its size. So S of T is an abelian group. So what order do I want to do this? If S has R generators, then how many elements are there in S? Well, remember that Pauli group elements square to the identity, or minus the identity, but minus I is not in the subgroup. So that means that if you take these R generators you're trying to figure out all the elements of the group, you only have to look at products of the generators, right? Because if you look at any generator squared, it just gives the identity. And moreover, the order of the product doesn't matter because it's an abelian group, right? So they all commute with each other. So the only thing that you can have as an element is a product of some subset of these R generators. And how many different subsets are there? Well, there's 2 to the R, right? Because each generator can be an element or not an element of the subset. So we know exactly the size of S. But moreover, 2 to the R is exponential in number of generators. But the generators are all that we really need to describe the group, right? Once we know the generators, we know everything else about the group. And so R is going to be polynomial in n. As you'll see, it has to be less than or equal to n. And so that means that to describe the stabilizer, all we need is order n we need O of n polys which each can be described using O of n bits. Right? Because the poly is just I, X, Y, Z on each qubit. So that's two bits for each qubit plus a phase out front. So this is O of n squared bits to describe the whole stabilizer. Whereas if you're given this code space, even just a single code word, if you have to write out the basis elements, well, it could be a superposition of 2 to the n different things. Right? And you need to say, you know, what the amplitudes of each of those things are. Even if the only possibilities are 0 or 1 over something, you know, 1 over some normalization, that's still quite a lot of bits, right? It's 2 to the n bits just to specify that. So this is a much more efficient description of the stabilizer the description of the stabilizer is much more efficient than describing the code words. And then, of course, you could have, you know, k logical qubits, in which case you have 2 to the k code words that you have to describe. So that's even more. Okay, so that's one immediate advantage of the stabilizer. And moreover, so I said you can derive a lot of properties of the code from the stabilizer. So one of those properties is how big is the subspace? How many logical qubits are there? And that's given by this result. So in particular, if S has R generators, then T of S has dimension 2 to the n minus r. That is, there's n minus r logical qubits. Okay. So why is that? Well, I'm not going to give you a full proof, but the basic intuition is pretty straightforward. So each poly has eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. Right, so it's splitting the whole Hilbert space into two subspaces, the plus 1 eigenspace and the minus 1 eigenspace. And what we're interested in for the code space is the plus 1 eigenspace. So each time we pick a generator, we're picking half of the subspace. So and every time we pick another generator, we're cutting it in half again. Right? So if we start with a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space, and then we put on R generators, we have 2 to the n minus R dimensional subspace left over. Okay? Now, of course, to prove that, you have to prove that, you know, each of these generators is really independent, and so you really are cutting in half again instead of, you know, the first one could cut in half, and the second one is, you know, has a high overlap with that, so it's not cutting in half. But it turns out that because of these special properties of the poly group, this actually does work. Okay? So at this juncture, it's maybe worth pointing out that stabilizer codes are not the most general subspaces of the Hilbert space, right? So you can for an arbitrary subspace, you can still write down the stabilizer. But when you go the other way, you're only going to get certain special subspaces, right? Those are the stabilizer codes. And those codes have special properties, and they're a lot easier to deal with than the more general case. But they're not all possible quantum error correcting codes. Nevertheless, there's quite a lot of interesting stabilizer codes. And most of the codes that people have considered are stabilizer codes. OK? Any questions? What's an example of a non-stabilizer code? Well, I mean, they tend to be more difficult to write down. So maybe I can't give you a good example. But for instance, there's some codes that people have discovered where the logical subspace is not a power of 2. Okay, and so then you know immediately that's not a stabilizer code.
For more details on stabilizer codes, read your PhD thesis.
Yes, that's definitely a place you could go. Again, it depends how many details you want. Okay, so are there questions? Okay, so now let's talk about really the main property of error-correcting codes we care about, which is how good they are correcting errors. So let's start off by thinking about how the action of the errors affects this property of being in the stabilizer code. So remember that for the 9-qubit code, we had two kinds of generators, right? We had generators that were tensor products of Zs, and those were the things that we were using to correct bit flip errors, right? Saying if they're the same or different in the standard basis. And then we had the generators that were tensor products of Xs. And those were the things that we were using to correct phase flip errors, Z errors. So what we see is that the Z things are used to correct X errors, and the X things are used to correct Z errors. So that gives us a hint that anti-commutation is key here. So let's make that formal. So let's say we have some error E, and we have M in the stabilizer such that M and E anti-commute. Okay? So we know that that M psi is equal to psi. So now let's look at the eigenvalue of E psi under M. So we take M E psi. Well, M and E anti-commute. So this is equal to minus E M psi. And M psi is equal to psi. So this is minus E psi. Okay? So whereas psi had plus one eigenvalue for M, E psi has minus one eigenvalue. Right? So doing something that anti-commutes with M switches us from the plus one eigenspace to the minus one eigenspace. Conversely, if we have M and E that commute, again for M and S, then M E psi equals plus E M psi, which is E psi. So if we have the error that commutes with the something in the stabilizer, the state remains in a plus one eigenspace. Okay?
That's a bad thing, right?
Well, it depends. So suppose our goal is to detect errors. So let's not think about correcting errors yet. We're just talking about detecting errors. Then what we want to make sure that there's at least something in the stabilizer that anti-commutes with each error that we want to detect. Right? It's not really necessary that everything anti-commute. Because once one thing anti-commutes, that's enough to tell us that there has been an error. Right? Now, in a moment, when we go to correction, it's actually good that not everything anti-commutes, because then the pattern of which things commute and which things anti-commute is going to give us information about the error. But let me get back to that.
Is that completely true, that M has to be in the stabilizer for that to be, for M an error?
Suppose M is in the stabilizer, then we know that M psi is equal to psi. So that's what we're taking advantage of. So if M is not in the stabilizer, for a specific code word, it's still possible that M psi is equal to psi. But if it were true that M psi is equal to psi for all psi, then it's actually in the stabilizer by this definition. Okay? So in order for this to be a meaningful question, then we wanted it to be in the stable, we wanted M to be in the stabilizer. Otherwise, it would have been, you know, ambiguous whether it's in a code word or not. So let's talk about detecting errors again. So detecting errors. So clearly, the thing we want to look at is the set of errors that anti-commute with the stabilizer. But actually, I want to define the opposite thing. It's a bit easier to deal with. So N of S is the set of N in the Pauli group such that N and M commute for all M in S. And N of S is a bit nicer to deal with because it's a group, right? If you have two things that commute with everything in the stabilizer, then the product of them will also commute with everything in the stabilizer. And so clearly, we can detect E that's not in N of S. Right, because that means that there's something in the stabilizer that anti-commutes with E. But actually, there's some things that are in N of S that I would still consider detectable errors. Why is that? Well, S is a subgroup of N of S, right? Because S is an abelian group. So everything in S commutes with everything else in S. So it satisfies the condition to be a subgroup of N of S. And moreover, if the error is actually in S, what does it do to the code words? Well, it does nothing, right? That's the definition. So it's not really an error at all, right? It's just like the identity. It acts like the identity on the code space. So, so actually, we can detect E if it's in N of S minus S. Sorry, if it's not in N of S minus S, right? Because that means either it's outside N of S, in which case there's something that N's commutes, or it's inside S, which means it doesn't do anything and is therefore not really an error. Okay?
Is the set N of S minus S like the set of logical operations on your actual?
So it turns out that N of S minus S is exactly, yes, they're the logical Pauli operations. And I think you'll explore this more in the tutorial. I guess I didn't look exactly at the wording of the problem, but that's something, definitely a problem related to that in the tutorial. Okay, so are there other questions about that? Okay, so... So that's detecting errors. Let's talk about correcting errors. Let's do it over here, I guess. So, so now we want to go further and not just say, okay, there was an error. We want to actually figure out what the error was and fix it. So, well, okay, maybe I'll do the logic before I write down this theorem. So the logic is this. So it would be sufficient if two errors E, F have different error syndromes. For all pairs in some set of errors that we're trying to correct. Okay, so what does it mean to have different error syndromes? Well, the error syndrome, remember, is basically the set of eigenvalues of the stabilizer generators, right? That's what we did, at least in the case of the 9-qubit code, to measure the error syndrome. We measured the eigenvalues of all the generators. Okay? So this is saying that E and F, well, okay. And of course, the eigenvalues are determined by whether E and F commute or anti-commute with that generator, right? So E has eigenvalue, gives us a state with eigenvalue plus 1 if it commutes with M, and it gives us an eigenvalue minus 1 if it anti-commutes with M. So this is saying that E and F have different sets of generators with which they anti-commute, or equivalently with which they commute. Okay? And what does it mean to say that they have different sets with which they commute? Well, an easier way of saying that would be to look at the product, E times F. Or it turns out to be a little better to look at E dagger F. Doesn't matter in this case, but when you generalize to qudits, it does matter. So let's look at E dagger F. And so if E and F both commute with M, or both anti-commute with M, then the product commutes with M, right? Because we either get two plus ones or two minus ones when we move it past. Whereas if one of them commutes and one of them anti-commutes, then that means that that the product will, if one of them commutes and one of them anti-commutes, it means the product will anti-commute with them, right? Because we'll get one plus one and one minus one. So in particular, if they have different sets of M with which they commute, that means that they anti-commute with at least one M in the stabilizer. And this is saying that E dagger F is not in N of S. Okay, so we see that this set N of S is coming up again. So this is saying that E dagger F is in particular outside, well, for one thing, it's outside this set of undetectable errors. But here I had this N of S minus S case. Here I just put the N of S. But this is just a sufficient condition, right? So it's sufficient if E and F always have different error syndromes. But let's think about this minus S. So suppose we have the case where E dagger F is in S, right? Well, that's saying that E dagger F psi is equal to psi for all psi in the code, which is, of course, equivalent to saying that F psi is equal to E psi for all psi in the code. So if E dagger F is in S, that means that E and F do exactly the same thing on all code words. Right? So while it's certainly true that they won't have different error syndromes, so we won't be able to identify whether we had error E or error F, we don't need to, because they do the same things. And so if we just get one of them, we just kind of can guess which one it was. It doesn't really matter, because then when we correct it, we'll be correcting the other one too, whichever one it was. They're the same state, so the same correction. And so the upshot is that the stabilizer S, or the corresponding stabilizer code, can correct a set of errors E if and only if E dagger F is outside this undetectable set N of S minus S for all pairs. Okay. So any questions on that? Okay. Well, this is the thing. This is very general, right? So you could let the set of errors E be the set of all single qubit Pauli errors, or you could let it be the set of two qubit Pauli errors or three qubit Pauli errors, or you could let it be some other set altogether, right? It's, you know, X on the first qubit and Z on the second qubit and X3, X, Y4, and so on, right? It could just be any set, and this is still a theorem. Of course, mostly we are interested in a case where it has some nice description, for instance, as all single qubit errors.
Why is it clear that just because you know what the error was that you can correct?
Okay. So suppose you do have an error syncrome that tells you what the error is. Well, these are Pauli errors. So this is the easy case. These are Pauli errors. So the Paulis are all invertible. They're unitaries, in fact, for qubits. So you just apply the inverse, and you'll get back to the original state. So once you identify what the error is, then it's pretty easy.
So these are Pauli errors because they don't belong to N of S minus S, or?
No. So the assumption, I guess I didn't write that specifically. But let's say that the set of errors that you're talking about is just a subset of the Pauli group. Right. So this is by assumption. But the reason, kind of the underlying reason that we can do that is because of what I talked about last time, that you can write arbitrary, say, single qubit errors as a sum of Pauli errors.
Okay. So, but you're assuming that they're single qubit errors also.
Yeah, obviously you can come up with error models where that's not a good thing to do. I mean, you can always still write arbitrary things as a sum of Pauli errors, but maybe you have to increase the number of Paulis. Maybe more Pauli errors in the sum than you had in the original set. That's certainly possible. Yeah, so this is definitely an assumption about the set of errors that we're correcting. Okay, so maybe some definitions. So first of all, we talk about the distance of a quantum error correcting code. So the distance of a stabilizer code is the minimum weight of an element of N of S minus S. Okay, so what that's saying is that the minimum weight, remember, is the number of qubits on which it acts not as the identity. Okay, and you see, so this is the weight of the smallest undetectable error. If you look at the kind of the analogous classical theory of linear codes, you don't have anything that's like this minus S. That's something that's special to quantum computing and quantum error correcting codes. And so we say if the distance of S is less than, is greater than the minimum weight of something in N of S, then we say the code is degenerate. Okay, and so that means that we have this case occurring, right, where we have two errors that do the same thing to code words. That's why we call it degenerate. Okay. And so the notation we use here for a distance decode is double brackets NKD. For code with n physical qubits. Okay, maybe I should raise this up a little bit. K logical qubits. And distance d. Okay. So notice that if you want to correct t qubit errors, that means that you need the distance to be at least 2t plus 1. Why is that? Well, so let's suppose we want to correct arbitrary t qubit Pauli errors, which will allow us to correct arbitrary t qubit errors. Well, by that theorem at the top of the board, we can let E and F be two arbitrary t qubit Pauli errors, which means the product of them could be weighed up to 2t. Right? But if the distance is at least 2t plus 1, then that means that anything of weight 2t cannot be an N of S minus S. Right? Because 2t plus 1 is the smallest thing in N of S minus S. And so that means the product of E dagger F must be outside N of S minus S. And therefore, by the theorem, we can correct errors, the set of errors. Okay?
And then by the other theorem, we can correct any combination of these t qubit errors?
That's right. That's right. Okay? Any other questions on that? Okay. So then let's see some examples. Well, we did see one example already. We saw the 9-qubit code. And so the 9-qubit code, by the way, I'm not going to write down the stabilizer again, but the 9-qubit code is a 913 code, and it's actually a degenerate code. How can you see that? Well, remember, the stabilizer had things of the form Z tensor Z in it, right? Which means that there's elements of the stabilizer that have, so it's a code that corrects one error, so 2t plus 1 is 3, that's why it has to be distance 3, but there's things of weight 2 in the stabilizer, and in particular in N of S. Okay, so that's how you can see it's a degenerate code. And if you, it's very easy to see how that's reflected in the actual action of the errors, right? Because you had things like 000 plus 111. And if you have a z on the first qubit, that becomes 000 minus 111, which is the same as if you have a z on the second qubit or the third qubit. Okay, so you have those three errors that all act the same way. Okay? Okay, so now let's see some other examples. So first is the 5-qubit code. So this is the smallest quantum error correcting code that corrects one error. And I'm going to write down its stabilizer. So this is what it looks like. So each row is a generator of the stabilizer, and I've suppressed the tensor products because it's a little easier to read that way, and certainly quicker to write. And so we have five physical qubits, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Four generators. And so what does that mean? That means we have one logical qubit. And then I claim that this code is distance 3. So there's two ways you could see that. One way would be just to try all weight 1 and 2 Pauli operators, and you'll see that they all anti-commute with some generator. The other option is to write down the error syndromes of all the single qubit Paulis, and you'll see that they're all different, right? And that would imply that this code is a non-degenerate code that corrects one error, and therefore its distance has to be at least 3. And in fact, it's exactly 3 because you can easily come up with 3-qubit things that commute with everything. I guess it's maybe worth pointing out that this code is what's called a perfect code because How many single qubit errors are there? Well, for each qubit, you could have x, y, or z. There's 5 qubits, so that's 15 plus the identity is 16 errors up to 1 qubit. And how many error syncrums are there? Well, there's 4 generators. Each can be plus or minus 1, so that's 2 to the 4, which is also 16. And so each of those 16 possible errors has a different error syncrum, and it uses up all the possible error syncrums. Okay? I guess the other notable thing about this code is that it's cyclic. I only had to remember this first generator, and then each of the others is a cyclic shift of it. So there's the fifth cyclic shift, which would be ZZXIX, but actually that's a product of these 4. So it's in the stabilizer, but it's not a generator because it's dependent. Okay?
People actually implement this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's been done.
And what does implementing this one as depth of code mean? Like actually simulating Hamiltonian?
Well, no. So that's one way of doing quantum error correcting codes. But in the context of a quantum computer, normally what it means is, these are the generators of the stabilizer, but you can use that formula there to go back and say these are the code words. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then write them down. And then you come up with some circuit. And there's actually a systematic way of doing this for stabilizer codes. You come up with some circuit that does a unitary transform from states of the form psi 0000 to these code words. And you do that and then say in your quantum computer, and then say you wait for a certain amount of time.
Stabilizer is messing around.
And then after a certain amount of time, well, usually in these experiments, what they'll do then is they'll do a decoding circuit, which will basically give you, the state psi and then kind of an error syncrome in the remaining 4 qubits. And then based on that error syncrome, you can do a correction to the original state. And then you have to do some tests to see if it really is the state that you started with. That's the way people do these experiments usually. Sometimes they'll artificially introduce errors in the middle just to make it all faster and more reliable, but that's the basic idea. If you aren't artificially introducing errors, the other thing you can do is you wait for varying amounts of time, right? And then you'll see what's the probability that you get the right answer at the end, and that will decay over time, hopefully slower than if you didn't encode.
And are bit flip errors more common than phase errors? Which one of these are usually more common?
So it depends on the system, but in a lot of systems, it's usually phase errors that are the most common, because they kind of represent decoherence and interaction with the environment, learning about the state of a qubit. So this is these kind of T1 and T2 processes are very common. T1 is actually not just bit flips, it's amplitude damping, so kind of like spontaneous emission. And then T2 is dephasing or decoherence. Those are two very common things, but not the only thing that can go wrong. Yeah?
What about the ratio between the distance and n?
Right. So obviously the 5-qubit code is more favorable in that respect than the 9-qubit code, which was the 913 code. And in fact, the 5-qubit code is the smallest code that will correct one error. As you go to bigger and bigger codes, it turns out you can come up with codes, although it's not trivial to do so, that have a constant ratio of distance d over n. And in fact, you can do that even while having a constant ratio of k over n as well. So you can encode qubits at a constant rate versus a kind of constant fractional distance.
All right, this code.
How are they called? So the easiest way to show that such codes exist is a randomized construction. So it turns out that if you just pick a random stabilizer code with high probability, it has this property. The problem is that it's difficult to come up with kind of explicit constructions. And there are some explicit constructions, but they're like algebraic geometry codes and stuff like that. Yeah.
Stabilizer code cyclic versus just by chance?
No, that's not typically the case. In fact, the next one I'll show you does not have that property. Any other questions? Okay, so another code I want to show you is the 7-qubit code. And so here's the generators of that. Yeah. So 7 physical qubits. If you count, there's 6 generators here. So again, 1 logical qubit. And it turns out this is also distance 3. So why am I showing you this code? After all, this 5-1-3 code is clearly more efficient than the 7-1-3 code. Well, there's 2 reasons. So one of them is that it's an example of a specific construction of quantum error correcting codes out of classical error correcting codes, which is called the CSS construction. So this is a CSS code. And so CSS codes, what you do is you take, I don't want to go into the classical coding theory, but classical linear codes have something called a parity check matrix, which is very analogous to the stabilizer. And so the parity check matrix of a classical code is just a matrix with zeros and ones in it. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take 2 such classical codes. In the case of the 7-qubit code, they're the same, 2 copies of the same code, but they don't have to be. And we're going to use 1 parity check matrix where we replace the ones with x's. And that code is then used to correct the phase flip errors in our code. And we take another parity check matrix and replace the ones with z's. And that is used to correct the bit flip errors in our code. And if both of these classical codes are good at correcting errors, classically, then the resulting code will be good at correcting both bit flip and phase errors, right? And so that's a very automatic way you can take classical coding theory and use it to make good quantum codes. Now, I can say there is one constraint that you have to worry about, which is this x part and the z part, remember, have to commute, right? You need an abelian group. And so that sets a constraint on the 2 codes you can use. It involves the dual of the codes. Again, classical coding theory stuff. Okay, so that's one reason that this is interesting, because it's an example of this more general construction, which is useful for making big codes. And the other reason is that the 7-qubit code turns out to be somewhat better than the 5-qubit code for fault-tolerant quantum computing. So I just mentioned how experiments to test the 5-qubit code work, right? You do some encoding circuit, and then you wait for a while, and then you do some decoding circuit. But the problem is, that only corrects errors that happened while you were waiting, right? It doesn't correct errors that that happened during the encoding circuit or the decoding circuit. And so you need a whole new set of tools to deal with such things. So before I say anything about that, though, I want to check if there's any more questions on, say, the 7-qubit code or the stuff we've been doing up to now.
What does randomly choosing stabilizer code and having those constant relationships between K and N and B and N tell you about, like, the stabilizer codes that are easy to write and the stabilizer codes that are just stabilizer codes? But
So in some sense, any stabilizer code is easy to write because it only requires O of N squared bits to describe it. The difficulty, there's 2 difficulties. So one is that if somebody gives you a random stabilizer code or gives you just an arbitrary stabilizer code, it's actually not an easy problem to determine what the distance is. Okay, so you know that if you pick a random stabilizer code with high probability, it will have good distance, but it's not easy to check that you didn't get unlucky. So that's one problem. And a related problem, and this is important for practical reasons, is that it's not actually just good enough that the code has a high distance. You want there to be an efficient decoding algorithm. So, you know, while it's true that if all the errors have different error syncrums, in principle, you can tell what the error is. When the distance is large, that can be a very difficult computation to figure out exactly what the mapping is from error syncrums to errors. Okay? And so in practice, we're only really interested in codes, well, that's maybe too strong, but for most applications, we're interested in codes that have efficient decoding algorithms as well. And that's a much more special class of codes. And random codes definitely don't qualify. So is that?
Yeah,
okay. Other questions? Okay, so now let's, in the remaining few minutes, let's talk a little bit about fault tolerance. So fault tolerance is actually fairly complicated, much more so than anything I've shown you so far. So I'm not going to go into any kind of details at all. But the basic idea is, well, we have to improve the error correcting codes we have by some additional protocols, which will let us do things like dealing with errors in the encoding circuits and errors in the error correction circuits, but also let us do computation on states while they're encoded. The goal here is to be able to build a quantum computer using these fault-tolerant protocols in such a way that if you know any gate has an error with some small probability, then if gates have small probability of error and the state preparations and the measurements have small probabilities of error, all of these things can be imperfect. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, we're still going to get the right answer, right? We want the same kind of improvement that we're getting from the quantum error correcting code, where without encoding, we had a probability of error that's order p. And with encoding, it could be order p squared or even smaller. And so one of the main barriers you have to deal with is the problem of error propagation. So for instance, if you do a C0, and you're supposed to start with the state 0, 0, then you're supposed to get the output state 0, 0. But suppose there was a bit flip error and you had a 1 here, right? Well, then what's the output state going to be? It's going to be 1, 1. So now not just the first qubit, but also the second qubit is wrong. The error has propagated along the C0. And it turns out that if you do this in the plus minus basis, you can get errors propagating the other way also. So this is a problem, right? Because notice that the C0 was not wrong. C0 was doing exactly what it was supposed to do. So it's a pre-existing error that spread. And so one of the main issues in fault-tolerant protocols is you have to design it such that the spread of errors you can't avoid it altogether, but you can control it and make sure that they don't spread from correctable errors into uncorrectable errors. And so one of the basic ways of doing that is something called transversal gates, which again, I don't want to go into details, but it turns out the 7-qubit code is much better for these transversal gates and in general for fault-tolerant protocols in the 5-qubit code. So that's one reason that it's interesting. Okay, so the main result of the theory of fault tolerance is the threshold theorem. So the threshold theorem says there exists some threshold error rate. Such that if the error per gate or time step, here let's call it p per gate or time step, is below pt, then there exist fault-tolerant protocols uh, for arbitrarily long quantum computations. So in particular, well, okay, I guess the overhead. So it's the ratio of qubits, physical qubits that you need to logical qubits, or physical time steps to logical time steps, is some polynomial in the log of t, where t is the length of the computation. Okay, so this threshold theorem is kind of a key enabling result for fault tolerance and for quantum computing at all, really. It's saying that if the experimentalists can get their error rate below this threshold error rate, then software can kick in, fault tolerant protocols can kick in, so that you can build arbitrarily big quantum computers. If this weren't true, then that would mean that to make bigger and bigger quantum computers capable of running longer and longer algorithms, you'd have to get the error rates down per gate lower and lower in the actual, you know, experimental implementation, right? And at some point that becomes unrealistic. Okay? Of course, whether this is a reasonable thing or not depends on what these threshold error rates are. It turns out, I mean, there's been a lot of study of this. It turns out that, you know, in some idealized error models, they can be as high as a few percent. And systems where you can do like long-range gates, and you don't really care too much about. This is an asymptotic behavior in the overhead, but unfortunately, the constants can be quite large. And if you really don't care about those constants, then you can get up, as I said, to a few percent. With some kind of more reasonable models like nearest neighbor gates in two dimensions, people have looked at things like the surface code, which seems to have threshold error rates about 0.7%. So that's pretty good. That's something that people believe they can get below. There's still a bunch of assumptions that go into that, but it definitely seems plausible that we'll be able to build quantum computers with those error rates. The overheads, unfortunately, are still a bit larger than you'd really like. But if that's the best way to build a quantum computer, then it's not going to rule it out. But the upshot is that we think that to build a big quantum computer, you'll need fault tolerance. And this theorem tells you that fault tolerance, at least the theory of fault tolerance, can make up for whatever experimental deficiencies you have, provided the experiments are good enough. Okay. So it really says that it should be possible, in principle, to build a big quantum computer. Okay, so that's it for error correction fault tolerance. Are there questions?
So generally, if I see an abstract that says fault tolerance or error correction, what's like the main difference between them? Like,
yeah, so error correction. Well, I can't be sure that everyone uses the words correctly, but but generally speaking, error correction is in this model where the gates are perfect, and all we have to worry about is errors, say, in the communication channel between Alice and Bob, or if you want to store it, Alice and Bob. Alice could be the past and Bob the future. So the encoding is perfect, the decoding is perfect, and the errors are only in between. Fault tolerance is a more general case where we allow errors during gates and really in all parts of the computation. And moreover, that we want to do gates on states while they're encoded. So we allow that possibility as well, instead of just storing them, for instance, or transferring them. OK?
So if I ever see a stabilization code with a K over n or d over n, both constants, mm-hmm. then I should expect that the decoding is going to be really, really efficient.
No, not necessarily. Like I said, there are some explicit families known that have these properties.
Actually efficient to decode?
I think so. Not 100% sure about that, but I believe so. I believe so, yeah. But not very many. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say that this threshold theorem is actually working in a slightly different regime. So, so the surface codes actually that I mentioned only have distance that goes like as the square root of n. And k is not does not scale with n at all. But the threshold theorem, you're dealing with an error rate p per gate, say, or per qubit. And so if you have n qubits, the expected number of errors is p times n. And so you might say, oh, I need a distance that's at least p times n. But that's not true, actually, because there can be special errors that are bad of that weight. But the typical error, the ones that occur randomly with very high probability, are things that you can correct. And so that's actually, for the threshold theorem and for similar situations, that's really what you want, is you want it to be good at correcting typical errors and not necessarily the worst case error. Okay?
So you were saying like maybe if we can do a computation itself while the information is encoded?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these fault-tolerant protocols, these fault-tolerant protocols include that.
Okay.
They tell you how to do that. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, so tomorrow we'll talk about quantum key distribution, quantum cryptography.